Wednesday, time for American Hit Radio, WHPC 90.3. Nassau Community College. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife, co-host, and now engineer as well, the multi-talented Heidi Morales Ryan. Here to keep things in order. Something that I seem to be incapable of doing week by week. I don't know why. I'm having so much trouble here lately. But, as you know, we have been working our way through a countdown of, well, two lists simultaneously. The top 500 of the top 40 and the alternative top 500, which is basically our choice of 500 albums that never made the top 40. Mixing them up that way together to give like equal representation to the well-known and the unknown, so to speak. Or maybe if not the unknown, at least the underappreciated from a commercial perspective. Today we're looking still at an album from the list of the top 40 albums. And this is actually number 54 in our entry on that list. We're going chronologically. We started in January of 1964. So this finds us in February 1968. An album that went to number 12 on the pop charts. And anybody who's a regular listener to my show will probably not be too surprised when I tell them that I have chosen for this album a Bee Gees album, actually. The Bee Gees' second album. Now, if you are going to discount the childhood releases that the brothers put out when they lived in Australia, then this album that we're discussing today would be their second album, released on Atco Records, their second international album. It's called Horizontal, and it picks up where their brilliant first album off of Atco had left off. The psychedelic touches that were on Bee Gees' first that made it so attractive are still intact here, but the band seemed to take a few steps away from one side of that album, and it was a great part of what the first album represented, which was the soulful side. They had like in their place, they put on songs by Robin, who has this developing penchant for melancholy.
Yes,
he gets more and more.
I've noticed that about him.
Yeah, I mean, this is the guy that wrote "I Started a Joke" and had a big hit with it, and he's moving in that direction on this album. This is just before that song came out, actually. So gone are songs that were really intended for, say, somebody like Otis Redding, such as "To Love Somebody" or "I Can't See Nobody." Really great soul songs that are interpretable by so many different people. And in their place now on this album, we have like these morose tales of regret, like "Really and Sincerely" and a song called "And the Sun Will Shine." The album also features two hit singles, whereas the debut album had four. So as such, this album is perhaps not quite as brilliant as its predecessor, but it still has more than enough to recommend it. It is full of really strange and unique lyrical references, for example, that border somewhere between simple observation and existentialism. Like, for instance, you know, "World" and the title song "Horizontal" suggest a penchant for self-analysis in their lyrics, and as filtered through a kaleidoscope, though, to give it that psychedelic edge. The songs that I just mentioned begin and end the album there, so they sort of sandwich everything else into that framework. The result is a really charming period piece that conveys the intelligent side of 1968-era hippie self-awareness. If anything, this might be the heaviest album that the Bee Gees ever made in their entire career. Their first album was a great pop album with just an unbelievable, you know, mess of great songs. But this album seems to get a little bit heavier. And in terms of rock and roll and in terms of what they're trying to do lyrically, it has the saddest songs, and it also has some of their most silly toss-off songs all at the same time. So let's get to it with one of those songs that I think deals with both self-analysis and existentialism. It was one of the singles off of the album. It's called "World."
Now I found that the world is round, and of course it rains every day. Living tomorrow, where in the world will I be tomorrow? How far am I able to see? Or am I needed here? Times I've gone wrong. Why do they keep me here? Now I've found that the world is round, and of course it rains every day.
Song, actually one of the singles eventually that was taken off of the album called World. We're going to be looking at the album Horizontal in its entirety by the Bee Gees. And this is a very, if you're used to disco era Bee Gees, you're going to hear a very, very different,
yes.
A very
this
different
is
band.
Way pre-disco.
Now it's the same three brothers that really never changed, Barry, Robin, and Maurice Gibb. Three brothers, all raised in Australia, became stars there, moved to England in 1967 and became stars with their first internationally released album, Bee Gees First. This is their follow-up, and this is an album where they're beginning to show a little bit of muscle for doing what they want to do, in other words. It's a bit more of an experimental album than the first one. It also really represents the band at a time when they really were a band. Barry, Robin, and Maurice were, you know, basically, Robin would sometimes play organ. Barry was the rhythm guitarist, and Maurice was the bass player. But they had two friends that were accompanying them. And at this point, they said that they were very much a band. It wasn't about the brothers. It was about the five of them. They had Colin Peterson on drums. And the very talented Vince Maloney on lead guitar, who were friends of theirs back in Australia, who came to England with them. And actually, I don't know if, I think they actually met one of them in England, having known him previously in Australia, if I remember correctly, how that worked out. Well, anyway, they ended up, after the first album came out, I find this rather incredible. That album was released in something like July 14th, 1967, just 3 days after the album was released. They're already back in the studio recording the next album. 3 days.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is the
no
way
sense wasting time.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, nobody would even think of doing that these days. You do that, then you go out on tour for seven or eight months, and then you got to write an album for 6 months, and then maybe 2.5 years later, you get another album. Back in the 60s, people were putting out 2 or 3 albums a year easily. Easily. I mean, the Beatles did it. They put out 4 in America on average in the beginning. So anyway, they were moving rather quickly, and they got into the studio. The very first song that they went to record is this next song. And it's rather interesting to note that Robin, who is seems like he's very key to the writing of this song, it's called And the Sun Will Shine, adds that this song is one of his favorites on the album because it's an emotional song, but a lot of the words just came ad-libbed. The song actually was never planned. They just played through the changes and basically added some lyrics as they felt it. And then they went back to it and tried to re-record it properly. And they ended up filling out the changes. They said, no, they liked the original version with the ad-libbing on it. So they took that version and then they overdubbed the extra instrumentation and ended up with what is a beautiful song. And it's amazing to me that it was ad-libbed at all because it certainly doesn't sound that way. Here is that track called And the Sun Will Shine.
And the rain will fall. It falls for you. And the clouds will break into tears. You should be here, standing so near to me. Said I know you should be sad, but give me time alone to get it out of my mind. Oh, I say I know it's only the
as a child, I would say that the Bee Gees seriously rivaled the Monkees and the Beatles
for
my favorite band. I was pretty much a huge fan of all three bands. Like we all go through phases. I guess the Beatles were the first, dating all the way back to 64 and 65. But around 1966, the Monkees took over. But it was in this year, in 1967, that the Bee Gees more or less attracted most of my attention. And these first few albums just struck me as brilliant. To this day, I am a total sucker for orchestration in pop music. Whenever I hear a pop song that's got beautiful orchestration, it melts me. I just find it to be something that's really special, and it's not easy to emulate. It makes these songs very difficult for any band to cover them, because there's always something missing if you try. And it's all that beautiful, lush orchestration. Now, you know, like Robin there, you can see what I'm talking about the melancholy that begins to creep into the album. And it's almost always, you know, Robin who is the person when that's happening. Barry, on the other hand, had a bit of a rock and roll edge to him from time to time. It's the type of thing that people tend to forget when they think of Barry as the disco guy or the balladeer. But he had a very strong instinct for rock and roll, and I think this next song proves it. Apparently, this song was written after, if you remember, on the time when Brian Epstein was found dead and the Beatles began to fall apart. And they were running Apple, and Apple was more or less a total mess from the beginning. So it was in the press all the time, all the stuff about what was going on. And Barry was hearing the stories, and he, rather than write about, you know, Apple in a very literal way, it would have been way too obvious, he began to like basically put down some of his thoughts about what he was hearing in the press and about how Apple desperately needs to be fixed. It needs to be changed, or else things are going to get even worse for the Beatles. And so he basically decided to change it to a song about lemons. And he wrote a song called Lemons Never Forget. This is it.
Incidentally, there should be some changes made. They fall.
song that's reasonably heavy by the Bee Gees standards, in a sense, you know. I mean, of course, it's called Lemons Never Forget, so there's a silly edge to it, too. But it's got that, you know, Barry's got a great rock and roll voice. And obviously, I mean, for me, listening to this album so often when I was younger, there's no way I'm ever going to learn to unlove this album. And, you know, since this is my list, this is where it's my job to basically... Right, convince
you
people.
You take your liberties, don't you?
Well, I mean, compared to a lot of the other albums that make a list like this, I mean, some of them are much less consistent, I feel. And I think this album holds up great. The next song is another one of the melancholy ones from Robin. Two really quick, actually, with tracks two and track four in the album fall into that sort of classification. Sometime around... I don't know where it was. I think it was called the Hither Green train crash. There was a train accident that had taken place in England. Then Robin and his future wife, then his girlfriend at the time, were on the train. And they were both almost killed. And it was, for him, it was obviously a bit of a life-altering experience to feel as though that could have been the end of your days right there. So he was actually ended up in France, and he bought one of these, like a piano accordion.
Uh-huh. Harmonium thing?
I guess. And he was learning to play it, and he wrote this song on that instrument right after the train crash. So it ends up being a song about his relationship, but really filtered through the fear that put into him. And you'll hear that little piano accordion on the track. It's called Really and Sincerely.
My mind is open wide, I'm on the other side. Though you remember my name, and if you go I'll get it off somehow. I'll leave it all in the air. No, no. Turn me down. Turn me down. I hear it all around, but I don't hear a sound. If you were with me now, I'd let you know my mind. Loving so easy to lose. No, no. Turn me down. Turn me down. Turn me down. Oh, I
One of the cool things that I loved about the Bee Gees back then, and really throughout their career, was the way, really up until the disco era, because at that point I began to lose track of who was who and who was responsible for doing what, because they both, everybody sang in falsettos. It was almost, it got to the point where it was hard to tell them apart,
right,
quite honestly. But at this stage of the game, it's very easy to tell Barry from Robin.
Who's who, of
They're
course.
Light years apart, you know, in terms of style and the songwriting style, vocal style, even the timbre of their voices, totally different.
And song styles. Really.
Yeah, absolutely. Robins were always the ones that would basically make you think like, sad sack songs, a lot of them. Well, Barry always seemed like there was like a certain amount of reflection, but he seemed to be a bit more of a rocker than his brother. And Maurice actually didn't write much. Maurice was doing most of helping with most of the arranging, but he didn't do an awful lot of the writing. Although, as I understand it, on this album, every song was credited to all three. But usually, it's the lead singer, like with the Beatles. Whoever's singing lead on it is the person who was the
generally
primary,
speaking, yes,
you know, creator of the song. This next one is a Barry song. It's sort of like an upbeat song about a breakup. Very 60s concept, I guess. It's called Birdie Told Me.
Birdie told me I must get over you somehow. And she told me never to think of you right now. But it's hopeless to say, how can I forget the way she used to love me?
Of all the times I played this album.
That was a false rock and roll ending of a different type.
right. Now that song, of course, very much a pop song. Another side of it. But this album, I mean, when it gets psychedelic, it gets really, I think it's incredibly cool. And this next song, I don't know, I've always loved this song. To this day, I would play this for people as like saying, you know, listen to this as far as how evocative it is and what it stands for. It's really just this, basically it's Barry's voice and a very loud organ supporting his lyric. And it's pretty much, you know, I do not need you. I do not listen to the words you say. Then he says, strongly I heed you. Like what? You know, but every promise seems to fade away. And then he questions himself, and then he ends up by saying, you know, I love you deeply with the sun in my eyes.
Mm.
I'm like, what a cool concept that is to me. It's like, maybe it's because he feels blinded
perhaps.
You know, there's so many ways to read into it, but I should just let the song speak for itself. Here is With the Sun in My Eyes.
I do not need you, nor do I listen to the words you say. Strongly I heed you, but every promise seems to fade away. Who is the clown that walks in the steps of my shadow? Is it the man who does what he can but never does it right? How can I prove there is no reasoning or asking why? Only to prove I love you deeply with the sun in my eye. Who is the clown that walks in the steps of my shadow? Is it the man who does what he can but never does it right? How can I prove there is no reasoning or asking why? Only to prove I love you deeply with the sun in my eye. I love you deeply with the sun in my eyes. I love you deeply with the sun in my eyes.
Back.
I love that song. I just, you know, songs that are, if you could know a song for about 50 years and it still seems evocative to you, but you can't put your finger on exactly why, that's a great song to me. It creates a mood. It's an atmosphere song that seems as though it could say almost anything you want it to say.
It's definitely got a romantic vibe to it, and I think you are a hopeless romantic.
Well, the Bee Gees, this is another reason why I think they became one of my favorite bands. At around the age of 10, I was probably ridiculously romantic, you know, in so many ways for a little kid. And this is an incredibly romantic band. I mean, Robin's songs about, you know, all of his inner hurt and stuff is romantic. And Barry's songs are gorgeously beautiful love songs from all different various, you know, ways of looking at it. This next song is rather interesting. After the first album came out, the Bee Gees had to come to do promotional tours. And they had to come to New York to promote what was, you know, they were becoming stars even here in America, with hits like Holiday and New York Mining Disaster being on the charts. And they had come to New York for the first time. And Barry remembers, for some reason, they were writing about a state in New England. They were writing about Massachusetts. And he remembers checking into the St. Regis, putting the bags down with his brothers in the room, and they started to write the melody together, singing about the state of Massachusetts, even though they were in New York. And then they took one of those cruise lines around the Circle Line thing that goes around Manhattan, so they could, you know, basically they're tourists. And on the boat, they finished the song. They came back, they recorded it. It became their first, I believe it was a number one hit for the band. Here's The Lights Went Out in Massachusetts.
Here I'm going back
Massachusetts. Something's telling me I must go home.
Biggest hits released by the early version of the Bee Gees, Massachusetts. It's off of the album Horizontal, which we are playing in its entirety for this hour. And Massachusetts actually kicks off the side two of the album. Now, the next track that I want to play, it's one of the weirder songs in the album, but there's a couple of stories about it that I think are really interesting and fun. First of all, this is a band that really got along with its management quite well. They were on Polydor in Great Britain, which was Atco here in America, who did all the American distribution. But they actually would like go to like the head of the label and eat dinner with him and his family and spend the night. And they said after they ate dinner, they would sit down on the floor and they actually started writing this song about a fictional race car driver. They just started to make up a story. And they liked what they had so much that on the way home, they went to Robert Stigwood, where he lived, who was the person who was their manager. Mm-hmm. And it was like almost 5 a.m, but they didn't care. They're throwing rocks at his window to wake him up because they want him to hear the song that they had just written. So Stigwood gets up and they could spend time together. They actually, they got along like that. Now, Barry tells a really funny story about it. I think this is a quote from the liner notes. Because as for the song's lyrical imagery of a winning race car driver, Barry says, it's nice to come up with things that give people pictures. For about a week after we wrote it, Robin walked around with a helmet with goggles on. He goes, he really did. And in those days, you could. You could literally wear anything because the flower power thing had taken over and whatever you were wearing was just fine. I remember standing in a lift dressed as a priest and Eric Clapton was across from me dressed as a cowboy. You would just look at each other and not say anything. Like, it was just fine.
That's funny.
Here's Harry Braff.
Checkered flag. Checkered flag. Checkered flag for Harry Braff. Checkered flag. Checkered flag. Checkered flag for Harry Braff. Goodbye, Harry Braff. It's so good to see him in the race. And the crowd feeling proud just to know they are there. And getting a good view of Harry Braff. Harry Braff. Three lines.
checkered flag, checkered flag, checkered flag for Harry Braff. Checkered flag, checkered flag, checkered flag for Harry Braff.
It's a slightly different mix than the one that I remember growing up that I hear on that CD with a lot of the horn stuff is new.
Oh, wow.
To me, anyway. The thing that's, that made this, the brothers interesting, I think, is, you know, Maurice would occasionally come up. Most of the time, Maurice's songs were the simpler songs, very heartfelt, straightforward songs is usually what came from Maurice. And I think this next song is one of the few songs on the album that Maurice is the lead vocalist on. And it just in content, and like I said, you'll hear it just seems simpler, more plainly stated, but it's a beautiful song. Another love song called Daytime Girl.
There she goes, my daytime girl, spreading her wings like a high flying eagle. All the people will stare as she falls to the ground. Heaven knows my daytime girl never been kissed. She don't know what she's missing. All the kisses there are to be found. Took advantage of this, taking time to remember the past, remembering all she has missed. What a dream this place has been, said when she lay, I believe when I saw him. Of this, taking time to remember the past, remembering all she has missed. There she goes, my daytime girl, spreading her wings like thank you.
that the Bee Gees had some of the most interesting orchestral backing of just about any band, including the Beatles. Of course,
that's
was
why they were dining with their bosses to get all that extra attention.
Exactly. Yeah, it could be. I mean, they were getting that attention, and it was brilliant the way that it aided the songs. Mm. The next track is really, I think, is a rather simple to understand. This is 1968. Everything is psychedelic. Barry writes another rock and roll song, comes up with a psychedelic idea. There was that Oscar Wilde story entitled The Importance of Being Earnest.
Uh-huh.
Right? So they just put a twist on it and almost as a joke called it The Earnest of Being George. And that's the name of this song, and I think they just had some fun lyrically. Here it is. Is titled The Earnest of Being George. A nonsensical title. Has nothing to do with the lyrics at all.
No.
But it's also interesting. We were talking about all of the wonderful orchestration. That track was just the five Bee Gees. There's nobody else on it but the five of them. So there you could tell that they were a very good, functional band. You know, pretty good players.
Who was it? Colin Peterson? And who?
And Vince Maloney was the guitar player. This track is probably the one song that actually fit the bluesy mold of what they were, you know, what they were doing so well on the first album. Not quite as successfully, but it gives, you know, Barry a chance to stretch out a little bit. It's called The Changes Made.
Look out my window, I can see tomorrow. Just a hallway of sorrow. When the change is made, and I've been a cry. Oh Lord, I've been crying. But I'll go on a crying when the change is made.
But what good's a good man after the change?
It's a very diverse album. There's a lot of different styles on here. You get, like, that's essentially a blues track, really, from the Bee Gees. It's odd. Now, that's just about put. You just about heard the entire album. There's one more track left to go, which will complete the hour, and it's the title song. And it very much like with the Sun in My Eyes. It's a psychedelic study that is really mood enhancing. It's one of those songs that I think basically goes with almost any mood that you want it to. And it's funny because they come about, at this point in time, they were trying to do the same thing that the Beatles were doing, experimenting with sound. They literally, like, said, what would happen if we overdubbed the same piano part 8 times? How big would that sound?
Wow.
And they did that. And then they like laid their own vocals on top of each other in multiple levels as well. And they ended up with this really cool, interesting, weird song called Horizontal. Became the title song of the album, and that's how we're going to leave you, folks, with this song. Hope you enjoyed this here in the Bee Gees' second album entitled Horizontal. Of course, Heidi and I will be back here on Friday as we continue our look. Oh, actually, we've got some live guests on with us on Friday. We're going to have Gene Casey and Pete Mancini.
Awesome.
With us on Friday playing some live music. So I hope you can join us then at 5. See you then. Meanwhile, thank you very much for listening. And here's the title track from the Bee Gees album, Horizontal. Bye-bye.
I have been lying under a pillow of dreams. Moments of swimming.